Sometimes the stars align and I come across a story that just unravels before my eyes. Every source gives way to another source, and I'm able to follow the documents like a trail of breadcrumbs to a wonderful feast of information at the end. This story begins and ends with a mystery, and it's probably one of the best things I've ever stumbled upon. Get ready, this one is going to be wild. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. There are certain things from our past that get a lot of attention. Like, there aren't a ton of movies or TV series about the War of 1812, but if you turned on the History Channel right now, there's about a 33% chance you'd end up watching something about World War II. Naturally, the other two-thirds are programming like Pawn Stars and Ancient Aliens, both of which physically hurt my soul. Similarly, the assassination of JFK gets a ton of attention, but most people probably don't even realize that Presidents McKinley and Garfield were also assassinated. I'm sure that you're thinking of other examples, too, right now as I speak. The thing that all of these events have in common is that they carry a ton of intrigue. And maybe that's a shallow analysis, but I really do believe that history is all in the packaging. Events that get presented to us in a fun package with a nice bow on top stay in the cultural zeitgeist, while things that are wrapped in brown paper with ugly tape all over them get pushed back into the realms of obscurity. It's just the way that it is. Whether the presentation is accurate or not, unfortunately. It's how we all ended up with such a disturbingly inaccurate understanding of Jamestown and Pocahontas. Disney gave us a nice package, and it became part of our cultural understanding. It's just how it goes. Another one of these historical events that just seems to permanently be a part of our culture is the lost colony of Roanoke. And I totally get it. It's like a movie plot. If you're not familiar, Roanoke was the first attempt by the English to put a permanent settlement in the New World. Of course, this was only an attempt, as the colony ultimately failed, but the circumstances around that failure and the resulting theories has propelled the story of Roanoke for generations as one of the preeminent American mysteries. The first colony of Roanoke was founded by Governor Ralph Lane in 1585 on Roanoke Island in what is currently Dare County, North Carolina. This colony immediately failed due to lack of supplies, poor relations with the native people in the area, and poor leadership. Following the failure of the 1585 settlement, a second colony, led by John White, landed on the same island in 1587 and set up another settlement. It is this second settlement that would eventually earn the infamous title of the Lost Colony. After only about a year of toiling, John White was sent on a mission to found another city by his superior, Sir Walter Raleigh. In his travels, White decided to return to England to gather supplies for his fledgling colony. But because of the Anglo-Spanish War, White's trip, which probably would have only taken about a year or so, ended up taking over three. When he returned with ships full of supplies, he found a startling scene. The colony was completely abandoned. What had been a busy village of about 120 English colonists was utterly vacant. Imagine that. You leave your hometown to go to college, and you say you're going to come back for Christmas break, but because of one reason or another, you don't, and when you finally do go back home after graduation, everything is gone. Your parents are gone. Your friends are gone. Your favorite deli has been deserted. And as you stand there desperately trying to piece together what may have happened, the wind gently twists its way through the neglected buildings and cobwebs. For John White, this moment was especially jarring as he had left his pregnant daughter in the colony, and now she was gone, as was his granddaughter. Faced with this terrifying situation, John White and his crew began searching for clues, and luckily they did find a couple. The word Croatoan was etched into a post, and on another post the letters C-R-O. They also noted that every building had been dismantled, the colonists' boats were gone, and that any usable supply had been looted, including trunks that held White's personal items, which he had buried before leaving 3 years prior. White and his crew return to their ship for the night, intending to further investigate the disappearance in the morning, but the anchor cable on their ship snapped and they had to return to England immediately. Despite only conducting a cursory investigation, White felt confident enough to report to his superior, Sir Walter Raleigh, that the colonists had merely relocated and could possibly be alive and well in another location. Which makes sense, right? Well, it's not that simple. It actually served Raleigh's purposes to keep the matter in doubt. So long as the settlers could not be proven dead, he could legally maintain his claim on Virginia. And it is in this selfish ambiguity that conspiracy is born. Despite the fact that modern historians agree with John White's intuition, there are dozens of ridiculous theories that have found solid footing in our cultural understanding of history. I don't like conspiracy theories at all. They're harmful. They can lead people to do dangerous things, and they are almost always predicated on faulty information and overlook very simple and realistic conclusions. Here are some of the most absurd examples. Some people seem to believe that the colonists were victims of mysterious witches in the North Carolina woods. There's no credible evidence to support this other than some dramatic misinterpretations of native lore, but alas, some people cling to this as the final answer. Similarly, some people believe that the colonists were possessed by the Wendigo or the reptilian spirit of the woods. And again, these theories rely on nothing more than a misunderstanding of native culture. Slightly more reasonably, there are some people who fully subscribe to an account of events recorded on a series of stones called the Dare Stones. The first stone was discovered in 1937 by a tourist. The inscription on this stone read, "Annias Dare in Virginia went hence unto heaven, 1591. Any Englishman show John White, governor of Virginia." This stone was taken to Emory University to be studied and would eventually be authenticated by the Smithsonian Institute and Harvard University. If true, this first stone actually proves that John White's intuition was at least partially true. This note was left behind by his daughter for him to find, informing him that his son-in-law and granddaughter had died. However, by 1941, another 47 stones had been turned in, all with varying accounts of what happened. After years of study and scrutiny, it was firmly proved that aside from the very first stone, the other 47 were complete hoaxes. Unfortunately, many people believe that the colonists were abducted by aliens, and I refuse to gratify that theory with any of my energy. Some people also believe that they magically transformed into trees, and again, I'm not gratifying that theory with my energy because, like the alien abduction theory, it's utter nonsense. It's truly unfortunate that people resort to such radical theories because the truth is almost as wild. Author Andrew Lawler offers a very potent summary of exactly how historians have come to generally agree with John White's assumption that the colonists simply moved on. He writes, "The sole clue to the settlers' fate was a post carved with the word Croatoan, then the name of Hatteras Island and its native inhabitants, who had been on friendly terms with the English. One of them, Manteo, traveled twice to England and was made a lord by Queen Elizabeth I. White also wrote that the settlers intended to move 50 miles into the main, an apparent reference to an inland site. The governor never located the settlers, who included his daughter Eleanor Dare and his granddaughter Virginia Dare, the first English child born in the New World. The case went cold until 2012 when researchers noticed a patch on a watercolor map of eastern North Carolina painted by White. Beneath the patch, they found an image of a fort at the head of the Albemarle Sound. Its location is 50 miles to the west of Roanoke Island, matching the governor's account. On top of the patch was another faint outline of a fort, this one drawn in what analysis said was invisible ink." Scholars speculated that White wanted to hide the existence of the fort from the Spanish, who viewed the Roanoke venture as a threat to their domination of North America and the critical shipping lanes off North Carolina's Outer Banks. And White's intuition was once again right on. In 1588, the Spanish did indeed send a party to search for, and likely kill, the Roanoke colonists, as rumors had begun to circulate that the English had discovered mountains of diamonds and a magical route to the Pacific Ocean, which would have been invaluable for trade. However, Like White, the Spanish never found the colonists. When archaeologists began excavating the hidden sites on John White's maps, they discovered a trove of European tools and pottery. In total, there would be 3 separate dig sites located, each revealing more clues to the fates of the Roanoke colonists. Mark Horton, who was an archaeologist at the University of Bristol at the time of the excavation, said, "This is typical in situations like shipwrecks. Order breaks down and you end up with several survivor camps. There isn't enough information to construct an exact recreation of the lost colonists' lives after they left Roanoke, but it can be generally assumed that they split up and assimilated with local native tribes, most likely the Croatoan who had proven to be allies previously." So if we follow this theory to its logical end, there would be descendants of these colonists alive today, right? Well, in the 1700s, an English explorer named John Lawson happened upon a group of native people in North Carolina with fair skin, blue eyes, and who could speak Elizabethan English as if from a book. It's pretty incredible to think that the lost colonists had never been lost at all. They left behind a note telling John White exactly where they were going. White's daughter left behind a note that proves she survived at least 4 years in the wilderness somehow, and it's quite possible that the colonists fully assimilated into various groups of the Croatoan and their ancestors live even today. That's so fascinating. I mean, I feel like that could pretty much be the episode. But what if I told you that one of these descendants of the lost colonists would eventually become one of America's greatest unsung folk heroes? But before we get into that, we need to pause for about 90 seconds for some ads. We'll be right back. Trust me. This story gets very intriguing, and you're not going to want to miss out. So hang tight. We'll be right back. All right, so maybe you decided to take the plunge and start a podcast. Maybe things are going really well with this podcast, and you're ready to start monetizing. If that's the case, let me tell you about Podcorn. Podcorn is my favorite way to find sponsorships. It is unmatched. Podcorn is a marketplace that connects podcasters to amazing sponsorships directly. There's no middleman. You can browse through sponsorship opportunities right there in the platform, and you can reach out to whatever sponsor happens to be there. There's opportunities for host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and much, much more. You never give up any of the rights to your podcast, and Podcorn is there to support you and help you every step of the way. The marketplace's mission is to give podcasters transparency, creative freedom, and full control of how and when they monetize. Click the link in my show notes to sign up at Podcorn and start browsing sponsorship opportunities today. Henry Barry Lowry was born sometime around 1845 to Alan and Mary Lowry, who operated a moderately successful independent farm in Robeson County, North Carolina. Beyond that, I cannot find much about this family tree. It sort of just stops there. However, something that is very interesting to note is that Henry, his parents, and his 11 siblings were classified as multiracial or as free people of color on various documents during their lifetimes. In addition to having the unique status of free people of color in the Confederate South, they had a sort of infamous reputation. The Confederacy used conscription to force many locals to work on the construction of various forts around the Cape Fear River area, for very little, if any, pay. Some of the Lowry's cousins had fallen victim to this practice, and having witnessed the exploitation firsthand, the Lowry's decided to do their part to fight back. The Lowry farm became a safe place for those wanting to escape this forced labor. The Lowrys and their associates formed a gang called the Lowry Band, and they did everything that they could to bring people into their farm, to hide them away so they could avoid conscription into exploitative labor. This noble act didn't go unpunished, though. A Confederate sympathizing militia called the Home Guard took it upon themselves to harass the Lowrys and accuse them of all manner of crimes. This harassment only deepened the resentment for the Confederacy felt by the Lowry Band. This resentment would boil over on December 21, 1864. James P. Barnes, a neighbor of the Lowrys and a member of the Home Guard, accused Henry's father of stealing hogs. A confrontation ensued, and in the fray, Henry Barry Lowry killed his first man. Only a month later, in January 1865, Henry Lowry also killed James Brantley Harris, a Confederate conscription officer, for allegedly mistreating the women of the Lowry family. These killings naturally brought attention to the Lowry band, and the Home Guard descended upon the farm. They held a mock trial, deemed themselves the executioners, and took the life of Henry's father and his older brother in a field by their house. An 18-year-old Henry watched from the woods as his father and brother were killed, and at that moment, Henry Barry Lowry dedicated himself to being a vigilante, the swift hand of vengeance upon anybody responsible for the death of his father and brother. Now, Henry was still a wanted man. The Home Guard had every intention of executing him when they went to the Lowry farm that day. He wasn't home, so they made do with the men they could find. Despite being a wanted man, he was able to lay low for nearly a year. Perhaps he thought that he was in the clear after staying out of jail for 11 months, but on December 7, 1865, the Confederacy would get its revenge by arresting Henry at his wedding. He was taken to a Confederate prison where he swiftly filed his way through the iron bars and escaped. He made his way back to his wife with love and hatred in his heart. He immediately set about the work of forming his own gang. The gang was composed of mostly Native Americans, but it also included two African American men and a Scottish immigrant. Together, they would send Robeson County into a time of peril that had likely only been matched by that of the Civil War. It began with robberies. The Lowry gang targeted the upper-class Southern elites. During their robbery spree, the Lowry gang committed many robberies with atypical conditions. Victims of the thefts were treated respectfully, considering the circumstances, and the victims could potentially avoid being robbed altogether if they could show that they couldn't afford it. The Lowry gang often returned stolen items such as horses and wagons when they were no longer needed by them. The gang, at times, was known for sharing their profits with the poor. However, as is generally the case with crime, it escalated. The raids were so frequent that they were hardly a secret at all. Law enforcement knew exactly who was raiding the plantations and robbing luxurious stagecoaches, but law enforcement officers who had the misfortune of approaching the Lowry gang usually found themselves 6 feet under. And with that, the Lowry Wars were officially underway. As the story goes, the first unsuspecting victim of the Lowry gang was a man named John Taylor, the head of the local KKK chapter. The Lowry gang stalked him, killed him swiftly, and escaped into the swamp. They would repeat this process with an unknown number of people. The Lowry gang became ghosts of the brush, phantoms who emerged from the shadows long enough to siphon the life from an unexpecting victim, only to fade back into the darkness again. Confederate sympathizers weren't safe. Racists weren't safe. The elite weren't safe. The Lowry gang put a target on the back of an entire people group, and they shot at it as often as possible. Some estimates suggest that the Lowry gang claimed at least 10 men in the span of as many months in 1869. And their rampage continued for years. They plundered, pillaged, and killed with almost no interruption, and as such, they were feared by all. In an attempt to subdue the gang, Francis Marion Wishart, colonel of the Home Guard manhunt, had the wives of the Lowry band held hostage in prison in 1871. Henry Barry Lowry and the other band members sent Wishart a letter demanding the release of their wives, on the threat that the bloodiest times there had ever been would be upon them if they declined. The women were immediately released. At one point, the federal government stepped in with heavy artillery, but they couldn't get their sights on the gang long enough to make use of it. Lowry's reputation grew as he continued to elude capture. Among the poor, downtrodden, and oppressed, he was a hero. A specter of justice in an unjust world. Among the elite, he was the boogeyman lurking in every shadow and under every bed. Eventually, even the federal government would give up the hunt. After the heavy artillery left town, the Lowry gang pulled off one last magnificent heist. Brigands in the South, daring robberies by the infamous Lowry gang, the safes from the only bank in the sheriff's office in Lumberton taken away, $25,000 of deposits stolen, a weak posse of police repulsed, the state government's reward for them dead or alive. Wilmington, North Carolina, February 17, 1872. The Journal of this city will tomorrow publish a startling account of one of the most daring outrages ever perpetrated by the notorious outlaw Henry Barry Lowry and his gang. Last night they entered Lumberton, the county seat of Robeson County, and made a most successful and lucrative raid upon the peaceful citizens of that town. The gang, it seems, first broke into Newberry's carriage manufactory, where they supplied themselves with such tools as they needed. They then visited the stables of A.W. Fuller, where they secured a horse and dray, and thus prepared, proceeded to the store of A.H. McLeod, from whence a heavy iron safe was taken and placed on the dray. They next visited the sheriff's office, in the county courthouse, from which his iron safe was also taken and placed with the other. With this plunder they started from the town, but as the sheriff's safe was found yesterday morning lying in the street, about 150 yards from his office, it is supposed that it dropped off and was abandoned. Early yesterday morning, as soon as the loss was discovered, the sheriff, being absent, his deputy, Alexander McMullen, summoned a posse, proceeded in pursuit of the outlaws. At a point about 3 miles from the town, they came up with the gang, but being too weak to effect their capture, a messenger was sent back for reinforcements. A large number of men immediately volunteered and followed at once to the scene, but the robbers had effected their retreat, carrying off with them the money, but leaving the safe and a portion of the papers behind. These, with the horse and dray, were taken back to the town. When it was discovered that the safe had been forced open with the sledgehammers and cold chisels, with which the gang had provided themselves at Newberry's establishment, the loss is very heavy, and consists of $22,000 in money taken from McLeod's safe, a lot of goods, and a number of valuable private papers were taken from the sheriff's office, and which were destroyed. Nearly all the money stolen was on deposit, which, as there is no bank in Lumberton, had been placed in McLeod's custody by different parties for safekeeping. Besides this, some $1,000 worth of merchandise was taken from the store, none of which was recovered. The books and papers contained in the safe were all secure. It was plainly evident that the store had been entered by means of keys, as was also the sheriff's office. Treachery on the part of so-called detectives is suspected, but this may all be supposition. The town has been in a tremendous state of excitement, which had abated but very little when this information was forwarded here. There was now a reward for $35,000 by the state government for the capture of the Lowrys, dead or alive. Nobody would capitalize on that $35,000 reward, though. After the Lumberton heist, Henry Barry Lowry disappeared for good. As is the case with any folk hero, urban legends about his disappearance quickly sprang up. Some said that he had committed suicide, burdened by the guilt of his crimes. Others said that he accidentally shot himself while cleaning his shotgun and was eventually claimed by the wound. His wife said that he was alive and well out west. His gang said that he slipped away to South America in the night. Some townspeople said that they saw him at a funeral just a couple years after the escape. Even as late as 1937, his grandnephew alleged that he was alive and well living out his golden years in the Midwest. Unfortunately, the only thing we have for certain is complete uncertainty. Just like his ancestors before him who vanished from the second colony of Roanoke, he too vanished in the night, never to be seen again. But that's not where Henry Barry Lowry's story ends. I mean, in a literal sense it is, but as a point of scholarship, there's still a bit to get into, because Henry Barry Lowry falls into the unique categorization of outlaw. When we study history, we run across people who exist in this sort of ambiguous space between cold-blooded criminal and championed hero. Pirates, Wild West desperados, and Prohibition smugglers all find themselves in this unique place. They committed crimes, some small, some massive, but their intent, at times, aligns more closely with ours today. And this puts us at odds. I can never condone murder, ever, But when the victim is somebody who has caused so much pain, like the head of the KKK or a militia of homicidal Confederate sympathizers, the wires in our brains cross, and instead of being shocked and saddened, we purse our brows and silently say, "Rad," to ourselves. It's why we like action movies. I mean, consider how many murders you've seen in the Star Wars films, or the John Wick films, or even the Bond movies. Honestly, if you think about it, like, literally, it's horrifying. But because we are morally opposed to the bad guys in those films, we get excited when the Death Star explodes and don't give a second thought to the thousands of people on board. There's a danger here, though. What happens when somebody deems themselves an outlaw and acts accordingly, but our philosophies are at odds? What happens when somebody decides to be the next Henry Barry Lowry, but instead of targeting the KKK, they target the Capitol Police? This is why our history education is so important. While the story of Henry Barry Lowry would make an incredible film, we have to position his story and the story of outlaws just like him very carefully. We must fully acknowledge their crimes, even if the stories are exciting and fun to learn about. Because if we excuse the crimes of people like Henry Barry Lowry in our history books because we deem their cause to be just, there may be people who see themselves in that story and then act upon the notion. I know that it seems extreme, but I think that we've seen some of this come to fruition recently. Perhaps instead of positioning outlaws as heroes, we bestow that honor upon people who fought for the greater good without committing crimes. Frederick Douglass, the Grimke sisters, William Lloyd Garrison, and the countless other people who used their faith, intelligence, and position in society to force change peacefully. Henry Barry Lowry did force change. In the years immediately after his disappearance, the local representatives gravitated away from the conservative Democrats that favored slavery to more moderate Republicans whose political philosophy did more closely align with the Lowry gang. But this change was born of blood, and its fruits were bitter and tasted of resentment. All right, guys, we've reached the end of this one. Thank you so much for listening. I had a blast researching all of this. If you like this episode, please share it on social media. It helps a ton. Speaking of, huge shout out to Ariel at Squadcast and Earbuds Podcast Collective for always mentioning the show. It seriously helps a ton. If you want to find some new podcasts, both big and small, check out Earbuds Podcast Collective. I'll drop the link in my show notes. It's a really helpful newsletter curated by different people each week, and it's a great way to discover new shows and genres that maybe you don't spend a lot of time with. Also, big shout out to Greg over at Indie Drop-In. Same thing, he is so good about shouting out this show, and it really, really does help. They are both friends of the show. I'm just going to try to remember to put links to their stuff at the end of every episode because honestly, they deserve it. Also, before I get into any fun announcements, I do want to say that this episode was brought to you in part by She Will Rock You. She Will Rock You is a really great music history show. I mean, not fully. It's like part music history, part interviews with current artists that you should probably know about. And if you like the music that I play at the outro of my episodes and you like finding new artists, this show is totally for you. It's hosted by two hilarious ladies, and if you have ever been a fan of rock and roll music of any variety, seriously, check them out. They did an episode on, like, the history of Gwen Stefani and No Doubt, and honestly, it was so good. So go check them out. Again, I'll have a link to their stuff in my show notes. Also in the show notes, you'll find a link to my website. I'm working on some of it, trying to get it more optimized. I'm trying to keep up with the blog posts and the transcript posts, but it's pretty hard. It's hard to keep up with all this stuff. So I'll put a link to the website there. Again, you can find some transcripts. You can find new episodes, some helpful links. Also, there's a link to the merch store. And as always, a portion of the profits from that store go to support UNICEF because kids should have a good life no matter what country they live in. Also, for any of you who stick around long enough to hear the personal updates and or care about them at all, start the new job tomorrow. Very excited. Send some good vibes my way because I've got a lot of things to learn. I'm excited to learn them, but still, It's always a little intimidating to, switch over to something completely new. So, anyways, taking us out today is a song called Hansel et Gretel by Patchworker. It is just some chill, lo-fi, shoegaze sort of inspired, like synth pop. Maybe not synth pop. Probably chill wave is what it is, but like, I don't even understand what that genre is exactly, because sometimes I feel like it's 80s ripoff music, and sometimes I feel like it's just lo-fi hip-hop. There's probably like three of you listening that actually even care and or know what I'm talking about right now, but to me, somewhere deep down, it matters. Okay, so here it is, Hansel et Gretel. I'm going to link some of their stuff down below as well, so if you are interested, go check it out. All right, you guys have a nice week.